May it please the court. My name is Tim Gwill, bar number 19489. I'm here on behalf of petitioner Vicki Carr. As you know, this is a workers' compensation matter. As you also know, workers' compensation can be sort of a strange area of the law. It has its own little universe, it seems. The issue, there are actually two points of error that petitioner brings to the court. Point of error number one comes from the language utilized in an order granting a motion for summary judgment filed by the respondents. The administrative law judge held that even if a safety rule violation was frivolously asserted by the respondents to deny temporary total disability benefits to an injured worker, that is not a violation of the Workers' Compensation Act. Petitioner submits that it is. The second point of error.
I want to hone that issue a little bit to see if I understand it.
Yes.
Are you saying that it's only a violation if it's a frivolous assertion of the defense or simply an unsuccessful assertion of the defense? Because as I read your briefs, it's the latter. It would be a violation of the act.
No.
There's
a body of case law, for example, Pueblo School District versus Toth, Jimenez versus ICAO, City Market versus ICAO, which stands for the proposition that the insurance carrier is held when denying a benefit to a standard of objective reasonableness.
Is that a statutory duty? Because it isn't penalties imposed for the violation of a statute, an order, or a rule.
That's correct.
What in frivolously asserting this defense, what statute, order, or rule was violated?
I would say that the Supreme Court decision of Scott Wetzel and the Savio case mandate that the insurance company process a claim in good faith. If the decision, if a benefit is denied, unless in a good faith review of the case, I would submit that as a violation of the statute. And I understand where you're going with your question. The specific statute is 842.105. 842.105, as well as other statutes mandating benefits under the Workers' Compensation Act, have a shall standard. The insurance company shall provide reasonable and necessary medical benefits. The insurance company shall provide TTD at a rate of 2/3 of the average weekly wage. When there is no legitimate dispute over an injured worker's entitlement to a benefit, and when the insurance company interjects a frivolous allegation, knowing from the outset that it is false, in order to do what the Supreme Court in the Wetzel decision described as pose an obstacle to payment, to negotiate down its liability on the case, I submit that is a violation of the provision of the act which mandates the provision of benefits.
Well, under the plain terms of the act, isn't just the failure to provide benefits a violation of the act?
I think it's an intentional failure to provide benefits, not a negligent failure in this case. But I believe under the act and under the case law that I'm relying on, the insurance carrier has the obligation to deny a benefit in good faith based upon a standard of objective reasonableness.
Mr. Quill, let me ask you this, because I know you were relying in part on the Jimenez case, and I believe Jimenez addressed a workers' compensation rule which discussed unreasonable delay and that the carrier cannot unreasonably delay. And so that imported reasonableness into the rule. Is there a similar reasonableness in the statute, the section that you are citing?
There's a reasonableness all over the Workers' Compensation Act. And I think, I think you're talking about the Farah case?
I was talking about Jimenez.
Okay, Jimenez. Yes, in the sense that there's not a statutory provision, no. But reasonableness is a part of the Workers' Compensation Act. To approach workers' compensation, I think we have to look at, understand, and appreciate the black and white letter of the legislative declaration. The black and white letter of the legislative declaration states that this is an act which is calculated to provide expeditious benefits to the injured worker without the necessity of any litigation. The Supreme Court, based upon that, has held that there is a duty to process a claim in good faith, and the Act does require active claims management in that context.
I have a different question for you as well. I know that in your brief, you've requested this court perhaps to not follow the Allison case, which says there is no duty on behalf of the carrier under that particular statutory provision. And if that's the case, can an insurance carrier act unreasonably if at the time of their action there is a court of appeals case that says there's no duty to act a particular way?
Well, there's a body of case law since Allison that says they are held to a standard of reasonable objective reasonableness. So yes, I think they can behave unreasonably. I think if the legislative declaration requires that claims be handled expeditiously without the necessity of any litigation, and if an insurance company withholds benefits, knowing that an injured worker is entitled to this benefit, and makes a false allegation of fact as justification, that is, I believe, a violation of the specific statute mandating the provision of that benefit.
But why isn't the simple denial of a benefit a violation of the Act? I get back to that because you're relying on a statute. And the statute 843.30.4.1 talks in terms, in the first section, of a simple violation of the Act. I think it's Articles 40 through 47. Okay, it doesn't impose an intent requirement or a bad faith requirement or an unreasonableness requirement. But you want us to kind of superimpose that on the statute, it sounds like.
I think it's already been done. I think it's already been done by the Supreme Court when it says that claims must be processed in good faith.
Well, I guess what I'm getting at is, it sounds like you're saying it's only when you violate the Act unreasonably that there's liability under this statute.
That's a good point,
go ahead.
Let me address, there's a footnote in the brief which talks about that, and I believe it was in the Jimenez case, which I believe Judge Casebolt, it may not have been Judge Casebolt, Judge Caparelli, I'm sorry, noted that it may not be necessary to find that insurance company unreasonably violated the Act to assert penalties. A simple violation may suffice. Now, reading between those lines, I construe that to mean, because this is a regulatory provision of the Workers' Compensation Act, and by the way, it's a provision that not only injured workers are entitled to, but insurance carriers, physicians, it's a provision that a judge needs to bring an errant party into compliance with the Act. But because it is regulatory, and because it does not have a foundation of intentionally or knowingly or recklessly, I would submit that, in fact, perhaps strict liability would be the standard.
Let's go back on that, because I thought most of the cases that apply 843.304 basically say penalties are not available unless you can show that the party had unreasonably violated an order, a statute, or a rule. So I thought the cases at least imported an unreasonable requirement as a predicate to finding penalties under 843.304.
Most of the cases do. The one case that may be the exception is the City Market case. And that's a case where, again, they made a holding that because the trial court had found unreasonable conduct, the court was not going to address the issue of whether it was necessary to find unreasonable conduct when there's a statute that's violated. And the policy reason, I think, would make sense in that even if an insurance carrier honestly makes a mistake in the adjusting of a claim and violates the Act in the process, if it has catastrophic consequences to an injured worker, why should the administrative law judge not have available to him or her the hammer of penalties to bring a carrier back into compliance or an injured worker back into compliance? So this is a regulatory provision of the Act. Yes, the great majority of the cases that I have cited do hold that if there's a that there's a standard of objective reasonableness, no question about it. And in this case, I am arguing that that Pinnacle be held to a standard of objective reasonableness. I think maybe strict liability might be a little bit too strict.
Collison didn't involve an assertion of a bad faith assertion of an affirmative defense, did it?
Excuse me?
Did Allison, the Allison case, involve an assertion of a bad faith or intentional or even an unreasonable assertion of an affirmative defense?
It did. Allison was a case in which the administrative law, well, it's difficult to read. It's a very abbreviated decision. But on its face, Allison involved a case where there was an unreasonable offset taken by Pinnacle. The administrative law judge initially imposed penalties and after a petition to review withdrew the penalty. The Allison court then held that Pinnacle was under only the duty to admit or deny liability. And it is petitioner's position that given the Savio versus Travelers case as well as the Wetzel case, which requires a duty of good faith in the processing of a claim, and that's actually the way it's worded is a duty to investigate in good faith and a duty to process the claim in good faith, that the Allison decision is erroneous. I would submit that the more recent case law and by far the great majority of the case law is more on point, which holds the insurance carrier to a standard of reasonable care in the denying of a benefit. With that, with permission from the court, I'd like to reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal. Go ahead.
Well, I do have a question about your due process claim. It seems to me your due process claim is that there is a denial of due process whenever the employer is permitted to withhold some benefits pursuant to this defense of a violation of a rule.
No.
Okay.
No.
Well, could you articulate it for me a little more precisely?
Yes. The director established the procedure in Rule of Procedure 6-4, which requires the insurance carrier to move to modify benefits. Pinnacle didn't do this. There are two due process claims. One is under the Whiteside, the Supreme Court decision of Whiteside, the injured worker has a due process right to temporary total disability benefits. The Whiteside court went on to establish three criteria to review. One is the extent of the deprivation. Here it's significant. Two, the likelihood of an erroneous withholding. The insurance carrier is inherently adverse to the injured worker. They have an incentive to withhold. And three, the state resources which are available to go ahead and eliminate this problem or provide hearing before there's a withholding of the TTD benefits. In fact, and I think this is on page 29 of my brief, that procedure has already been established in this case by the director. Under that procedure, when an insurer seeks to suspend, modify, or terminate temporary disability benefits pursuant to a provision of the Act, the insurer may file a petition to suspend, modify, or terminate.
But here that's not what's happening. The insurer is denying benefits. It's denying liability for benefits. It's not suspending anything or modifying.
It made an allegation.
That's right.
It made an allegation.
Are you saying then that anytime a company asserts any defense to liability, it still has to pay out the benefits in full and then seek recovery of those back?
That is exactly what this rule requires.
All right, so if the company's defense is, we have no liability at all because you were not on company business at the time of your injury, you're saying the company still has to pay it out and then go to court or go before the administrative tribunal and seek a refund?
They have an obligation to comply with 842.105, pay out at two-thirds the rate. This is critical to my case, and I've got 34 seconds left.
You have all the time you need to answer the question.
842.103 is the provision that provides the exceptions to 842.105. 842.105 requires that benefits be paid out at a rate of two-thirds of the average weekly wage. 842.103 specifically references 105 and creates a list of several exceptions to that rule. For example, if the injured worker is receiving unemployment benefits, the insurance carrier is not required to go ahead and pay out at two-thirds. If the injured worker is receiving disability benefits from an employer-provided pension, the insurance carrier is not obligated to pay out at two-thirds. However, if the insurance carrier is going to deviate from 842.105, and if the exception does not exist and has not been created by the General Assembly under 842.103, it must petition to modify. The director has noted in this rule that the issue of an offset gives, the director has noted in the rule that because an offset is always at issue here, that an expedited hearing in less than 40 days shall be provided to the insurance carrier. So what this is supposed to happen is under 842.105, they're supposed to pay benefits at two-thirds, file a petition to modify, and let the claimant address the issue at hearing before benefits are taken away from the claimant.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. I'm Harvey Flewelling, attorney for the respondents Pasco SW and Pinnacle Assurance. We ask that you affirm the decision of the Industrial Claim Appeals Office. First, I'd like to explain the test for penalties under the Workers' Comp Act, 843.304. It's a two-pronged test. First, you have to have a violation of a statute or an order or a rule by the director of the Division of Workers' Compensation. If there is such a violation, then you get to the question of whether the violation is objectively unreasonable or not. This has been recognized in the cases cited by the claimant in this case. I'm sure Jimenez, Toth, and I think a couple others. So here, the initial test for the ALJ would have been, has there been a violation of an order, statute, or rule? The Allison case states there is no violation of an order, statute, or rule when an insurance company files an admission for temporary disability benefits, taking a 50% penalty, as long as it pays according to what it has admitted for. That's in the Allison case, that's in the Colorado Compensation Insurance Authority versus ICO case, which is cited in my brief. But the claimant has the initial burden to prove the entitlement to temporary disability benefits.
Mr. Flewelling, I do have a question about that. You say an order, statute, or rule. Doesn't 304 also list a duty? How does it read it? Any duty lawfully enjoined.
And that, my argument would be that duty is something that is required by the Workers' Compensation Act, a statute, an order, or a rule promulgated pursuant to the Act.
And I understand that Mr. Gwill is arguing, well, in the Savio case, for instance, a duty has been created, maybe a common law duty, but a duty to act in good faith. So would Section 304 apply to common law duties?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. And Savio recognizes that the Act does not create any sort of good faith duty. We're talking about separate duties. Savio recognizes that bad faith claims are a common law tort action. They're not created by the Workers' Compensation Act. And the Industrial Claim Appeals Office cited Savio in its decision here and has for many years for that proposition. And the legislature obviously should be presumed to be aware of the Savio case and as the Allison case as well. They have, you know, for Allison was decided in 1995, so it's been 15 years. They haven't taken any action to legislatively overrule Allison or Savio. And Savio, as well as the Scott Wetzel case, they're common law bad faith cases. They don't involve duties pursuant to the Workers' Compensation Act or rules or an order.
Let's look at the duty, I think, identified in Allison. You have a duty to file or to admit or deny liability. Is that correct?
The duty is to pay. I'm sorry. No, it isn't.
Okay, good.
The duty in Allison is to pay benefits in accordance with the admission of liability. So there is no duty to actually admit liability.
Or deny.
Or deny.
Okay, so there's no duty to admit or deny.
I'm sorry. There is a duty to timely admit or deny benefits under a statute of the Workers' Compensation Act. So I'm correcting myself there.
Well, if there's a duty to timely admit or deny benefits, can you fail that duty by failing to admit liability with respect to benefits, failing unreasonably to admit liability with respect to benefits, which would invoke the second part of your penalty test?
The case law that interprets the statute that requires the insurer or self-insured employer to timely admit or deny, they don't go, I suppose the question is whether it's a timely admission or denial. I believe it's, I just don't have what the actual time limit is, but the only requirement is to either admit or deny. There's no requirement that you must admit or that you must deny.
Or that you, with some type of justification, admit or deny.
There is no requirement that says you must have some sort of justification. That's correct.
Well, what about the FARA case? I mean, it's a much more recent case. How is that distinguishable from the present situation?
Well, with all due respect to the court, I believe FARA was wrongly decided. However, as I stated in my brief, it's distinguishable because there was a specific rule on which the penalty claim was based, and that was the rule that stated the insurer shall not unreasonably deny prior authorization for medical treatment. This is not a medical treatment case. This has to do with temporary benefits. There is no rule that says the insurer shall not unreasonably reduce temporary disability benefits. And obviously we have the Allison case that says the insurer has the right to file an admission for only what it is admitting liability for, thereby reducing benefits based on a safety rule violation.
Is there a statutory obligation to pay these temporary benefits?
The only obligation, according to Allison and the CCIA versus ICO case, is to pay in accordance with your admission. So,
and I'm asking, apart from Allison, is there a statutory duty to pay these types of benefits, temporary benefits?
Not absent the claimant proving their case before an ALJ. It's the claimant who has the burden of proof.
So in other words, the claimant doesn't get any temporary benefits paid to him until after you've gone to a hearing?
Unless the insurer voluntarily admits, then the claimant must go to a hearing to prove entitlement. That's totally separate from a claimant becoming a plaintiff in a common law tort case alleging bad faith. They could say the insurer didn't in good faith investigate the claim. That's a totally different situation than what we have here, which is solely statutory penalty under 843.304, which was alleged.
But once the determination is made that the benefits are payable, as the claimant contends, then the ALJ has necessarily found a violation of the Act, has it not? You were obligated to pay certain benefits. You did not. You must. You have violated the Act, therefore you must pay the benefits.
Any violation would come into effect if the insurer disobeyed the order that said you must pay benefits.
Well, it's only pursuant to the Act that you have to pay benefits. So when the ALJ orders you to pay benefits, it's necessarily finding that by not paying them, you violated the Act.
I disagree, Your Honor, because, again, the claimant has the burden of proof. So the prerequisite for the duty to pay the benefits would be proving your case before the judge, being ordered to pay the benefits. But that doesn't prevent the insurer from voluntarily admitting liability for whatever amount of benefits it believes it would be liable for. And then still the claimant has the ability, and as in this case, where if there has been something reduced due to a safety rule violation, the claimant still has the ability to go to a hearing and obtain an order requiring payment of those benefits. And that's, it kind of goes along with the due process argument. The claimant has not been denied the right to a hearing. The process has been provided. And in the end, the claimant was paid 100% of the temporary disability benefits that were ordered. As far as the director's rule of procedure 6-4, I think Judge Jones pointed out that that procedure only applies to admitted benefits. So you don't move to modify or suspend benefits that you haven't even admitted for to begin with. It's a prerequisite that there have been either ordered or admitted benefits before you even get to rule 6-4. And finally, I mentioned briefly in my brief that this has been an issue that has arisen for quite a few years. The agency, the ICAO, and the director of the Division of Workers' Compensation have interpreted the act consistently with the Allison case for many years, and I request that you give deference to that interpretation of the act as part of the standard of review.
Mr. Fluen, I do have one question. If you can clarify in the record, I believe in the briefing there was a bit of a dispute of whether this issue was withdrawn at the hearing back in November 08 or whether it was just held in abeyance pending the result of that hearing.
Unfortunately, the record isn't, I'm not sure because I wasn't involved, and the record obviously isn't clear on what happened. The judge said something to the effect that there was a dispute as to whether it was really held in abeyance. So the judge did go ahead and determine the motion on the merits, and so we're defending this appeal on the merits as well. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. The case will stand submitted, and you wish in due course. Court will stand in recess, and the bailiff will so announce.